You know, this show is truly blessed by having a friend in Mr. Glenn Rivera, who is officially our executive director of talent booking. I must tell you, Glenn has brought some amazing guests to this show, and we've appreciated much. By the way, you can find out more about Glenn at shadesof70s.com. That's all spelled out, no digits. That's shadesof70s.com. Tonight, Glenn has arranged for none other than Henry Stone to be on the show. Now, we've had some impressive guests on this show and some wonderful guests on this show. But I've got to tell you, Henry Stone's pedigree and his lineage in the dance music business is astounding. In fact, I hardly know how to introduce the man. I can tell you he was born and raised on Jackson Avenue in the Bronx, and he was born June 3rd, 1921. His family stayed in the Bronx until he moved to Manhattan's Washington Heights neighborhood, and Henry remained in the New York area until he was 8 years old. And when he was 8 years old, he went away to an orphanage in Pleasantville, New York, after his father passed away. He remained at that orphanage until the age of 14, which really gave me pause. I must tell you that in 1929, an orphanage had to be, well, what I would perceive to be a grim experience. I'll be interested in hearing what he has to say. He was there for 6 years. Losing your father's bad enough without having to be, well, difficult. He began his career in the very early days selling 78 RPM records. He later, he sold records out of the back of his car in L.A., as a matter of fact. He later went on to sell to jukebox owners throughout the state of California. He later went on to start his own companies, a blues label called Rockin', and a gospel music label called, you gotta love this, Glory in Florida. And, after he, well, it's a complicated story. I'm not equal to the task of telling you all about Henry Stone, so let's have the man himself. Henry Stone, welcome to Strictly Confidential.
Hey, Peter, welcome. And here I am. Here's the amazing Henry Stone, like you said.
The amazing Henry Stone. Henry, can you hear me okay?
Yeah, pretty good. Very good, Peter.
Wonderful. If there are any changes there, you just let us know. The studio has lots of dials and knobs, and they can fix that right up for you. I should tell you, Henry, we're a little bit on a wing and a prayer. We had some terrible storms in North Florida today and knocked out some of our internet connectivity. So if my end goes bad here, you just hang on and Bob will play one of the tracks and I'll be right back and I'll dial in on a regular landline. We're streaming into the studio now.
Do you think you have enough music to play?
You know, God bless Glenn. He has made some medleys for us, some wonderful medleys of everyone from Casey and the Sunshine Band to George McRae, and yes, there's some wonderful stuff here. Glenn has done a great job of editing it down to a more friendly radio version, and so yeah, I'm always enjoy playing the music on the show. Henry, 8 years old, going to an orphanage, yet you've risen to the top of the music industry. You're known all over the world. You have more platinum and gold records than I could possibly count. The printout of the music that you've recorded is longer than all of my arms put together. And I finally stopped the printer. It kept going on and on and on. Amazing. Tell me about Henry as an 8-year-old.
Oh, well, Henry as an 8-year-old was he was a nice little character, and what I did do was I learned how to play trumpet at the orphanage when I was 8 years old, which helped me to further my music career as I got older. Because when I did get out of the orphanage, I studied music, and then I ended up going into the Army, where I was in the Army band at Camp Kilmer, New Brunswick, and it was the first integrated Army band. And basically, that's where I really got my feel for blues music, I would say.
Well, that's a great story. So then, being in the orphanage wasn't as, if you had music as much as you love it, that must have helped you get you through those years.
Oh, they were great years. You know, they were great years as far as I was concerned, because it took me off the streets of New York and put me into a nice place where I could learn. And the thing I really did learn was music, which really made me a very happy young man.
Henry, what do you think drew you to the trumpet?
Oh, it was just one of those things. You know, I ended up being the bugler and the trumpet, playing the trumpet. I was also the bugler in the Army. I was very attracted to the trumpet for one reason or another. And I ended up being a fairly good trumpet player. Not a great trumpet player, but fairly good, because when I did get out of the Army, I did hock my trumpet and go into the record end of it, which I'm very grateful for, which took me through a lot of years, as you know.
Well, the band that you played with, apparently it was one of the first racially integrated bands in the military. Is that correct?
That's right. One of the first military integrated bands.
And I believe back in those days they actually referred to it as race music, or did that come later?
No, race music was referred to as the record, the early record that were made in the late 40s and 50s when the records started to hit the scene after the war. See, records were made of shellac, and during the war there was no records being made. But after the war, it kind of like sprouted up there in California with 545 independent record companies, Modern Records, Exclusive Records, Cadet Records, just a bunch of small little labels, which I represented in California.
Henry, some of our listeners may not really understand what a 78 is. Now, if I'm correct, I believe most of the 78s, that at least the ones I'm aware of, were all 10-inch records,
and
they were made of
78 RPM. This were the pre-records before 45s and 33s.
I remember back in the day of having a record player that had the reversible needle, the one for 33, which had the smaller stylus, and the one for 78. That things have changed quite a lot. Now, you went through 78s and 45s and 33s and reel-to-reel and cassette and CD. This blows me away. You have tracked every curve in the music industry in terms of distribution and artists. It's really, frankly, amazing. What are you doing now with the digital?
Well, I have a website where I put up a lot of my older music from the 50s and the 60s. Like in the 50s, where I recorded Ray Charles when he was a young blind musician here in Miami. That was the 1950s, and then in 1955, I recorded and found James Brown with Please, 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 and through all the years, I became like James Brown's godfather. He never made a move basically without me until he passed away.
Wow.
All through those great James Brown records, I was involved one way or another.
Well, you know, I have to give you kudos for what you're doing. Glenn does it too, and I like to think that I'm playing my part. Certainly Victor of VJC up at Disco 935 in New York, and many others do, to try and keep this music alive. In fact, I think I'm quoting Glenn when I say there's a time that this music lives again, and that time is now. But I think it's wonderful that you're actually putting the older music as a digital download, because by and large, a lot of the older music is simply impossible by any means to find anyway.
Well, one of the main reasons for that is, Peter, is that with all the mom and pop record stores going out of business, and all you have are the Walmarts and the Targets, and they carry just try and hit record. So there's no catalog being sold other than on the internet right now.
I see.
So I'm trying to capture that market.
Apparently, with Ray Charles, there was the family was attempting to keep the music rights for Ray Charles, if I read that right.
Well, they tried to, but I won my case, and I ended up with owning the four sides that I recorded in 1950.
What was Ray Charles like in 1950?
1950, he was just a young, blind musician that I heard about in Jacksonville when he was going to the same school for the blind in St. Augustine, Florida. And when he ended up in Miami, at that time I had a meeting with Sam Cooke. He had a meeting at the one of the hotels over in Overtown, and he brought Ray Charles along with him, who was in Miami looking for a gig at that time. And we got into conversation, and I told him I heard about him. I heard he was a good musician, and he sang pretty good. At that time, he was sort of singing in the Nat King Cole flavor. So I always had, people play golf, et cetera, and pool. I always had a recording studio in my back pocket. That's why you go list all those thousands and thousands of masters that I own. Because I just love to make records. Way back then, even though I was in a distribution business, I always loved to make records, and that's when I recorded Ray Charles in the back of my distributing company.
Well, was Ray playing in clubs at the time that
yeah.
you met him?
He was gigging in a few clubs down here in Miami, and he wanted to pick up a few extra bucks, so I took him in this my little studio, and I recorded these four sides with him.
And those four sides were all 78s, if I have that right.
Oh, yeah. The time when I released them, they were 78.
I see. And did those still exist in any form? Those early facts?
Right on my website, you can pick them up right.
And by the way,
henrystone.com.
Yes, we are posting your website in the chat room. But many of you who are not in the chat room, you really must. You've really got to stop by henrystonemusic.com. It is an amazing site. It really is. And the music selection there, and not to mention the history, is just astounding. Well, your first record was Crystal Recording Company. When did you form that?
Which company was that?
That was Crystal Recording.
No, that was just a little studio I had. I called it the studio. So actually, my first real label was Rockin' Records, where I released the Ray Charles records on, and a lot of old blues records on the Rockin' label. That was about 1951 and 52.
I see. And James Brown, what was he like back in those days? Was he any calmer, or was he just as out?
Young, energetic James Brown with a lot of gusto, and he had that star power. The first day I met him in Augusta, when I went to pick up the Please, Please, Please record, along with Ralph Bass, the both of us got there from Sid Nathan King record, and his attitude and everything was unbelievable. He just knew he was going to be a star, and I agreed with him, and I promised him I would take Please, Please, Please and take it on the road and make it a hit record. And he just never forgot me for that. Because he knew I was very, very instrumental in making that record a hit.
Now, back in those days, how were musicians paid? Was it a percentage of the sales, or was it a recording for the hours involved in recording?
Well,
what was it like?
For hire in the early days. I mean, there were no power contracts. It all came in later years, you know?
I see. And after James Brown and Ray Charles, this is so early in your history. Actually, before them, you had the gospel group that was Reverend A. Johnson's "God Don't Like It." What was that? Apparently, that was a big hit on Glory Records or Glory in the Far.
That was a big underground hit. It became a gospel underground hit. I mean, at that time, I used to walk in the record stores, and the dealers used to have them underground where the people would walk in, we need that. God don't like it. God, he don't like it. I was like, it was wonderful. It was a wonderful record.
I see. And that goes back so many years. Well, from those days, how did you get to KC and the Sunshine Band? And that seems such a huge leap. I can't conceive of how you got from there to there.
Well, that came later on in the early 70s. Actually, you want to hear the Casey story? Casey came to me. Casey was working in a record store in Hialeah, Florida, and my main office was in Hialeah, Florida. And Casey came to work for me as a shipping clerk and picking records, sweeping floors, doing whatever he could do to be around my recording studio. And I hooked him up with a young producer or engineer at the time, Rick Finch. And I hooked the both of them up, and they used to go into the studio 3-4 o'clock in the morning after everybody was through doing what they're doing. I had a little 8-track studio above my office. And this was all pre-TK, right before TK. And they just wanted to be around making records. So I let them mess around and make records. Actually, the first record they did do, of course, was Rock Your Baby with George McRae.
And that fact astounded me. Why didn't KC do that themselves? Because the song is remarkable, and everyone loves that song.
KC, I was in my office, and Rick and KC came down to my office with the track that they had just cut of Rock Your Baby, the track, and KC tried to sing it, and it was too high for him. And George McRae at that time had brought his wife, Gwen, to my studio. He drove down from West Palm Beach, and he was sitting in the studio about 2 o'clock in the morning, and we used George for background, some of our background over at our studios. And I said, take George upstairs and see what happens with George. He's got a high voice. And about a half hour later, they came down with the first cut with George singing Rock Your Baby. I said, that's it. Don't touch it. And I released that record immediately. And about 2 weeks or a week, 10 days later, we started to get unbelievable calls.
Well, that song was not only tremendous on the radio, it was played in every club on the planet.
It was number one in every country in the world. Every country, including Turkey, Israel, you name it.
That's number amazing. One. That's an amazing. When you first heard it, did you have an inkling that it would be that big?
I thought it'd be just another great record. I had no idea it would be such a big worldwide hit.
Well, when you first met George McRae and his wife, who is Gwen, was Gwen singing too at the time?
Yeah, Gwen was singing. That's why George brought her down to the studio to do some recording. I mean, actually, it was Gwen's session that Rick and Casey, after she was through, messed around with this track they had on Rock Your Baby.
I see. There's a medley that Glenn put together for us, and late in the medley, she does a song that I had not heard before that is absolutely remarkable, and is the title, it's something about jazz, is it... What is that song? Jazz Freak. What a track. What is the history of that particular song? It blew me away.
Well, Clarence Reed wrote that song. Are you familiar with Clarence Reed?
Yeah.
Clarence wrote that song. And it was just one of those hidden songs that I had hidden away. But I originally did it with an artist that was pretty unknown by the name of Paulette Reed. So when I decided to cut this album, this When McRae Sings TK, I pulled this track out because I thought it'd be perfect for her. And as you say, it's a great track.
Well, is it true that you've re-released a compilation of Gwen just recently?
Yeah, well, it's a couple. Actually, it's not really a couple. It's a kind of, I redid a lot of the TK hits, about 13 TK hits, with Gwen's conception of them. Like, she does a Rock Your Baby, she recorded Rock Your Baby, What You Won't Do for Love, the Bobby Caldwell song. In fact, on this CD, I have Casey is playing on that CD and singing with Gwen, and Little Beaver and Timmy Thomas and Lattimore. So the original TK session musicians are on this Gwen McCrae sings TK.
Well, she does an interval there that she's thanking so many people and praising so many people for her career and people that she loves, which is a remarkable segment. That had to be unscripted. Unscripted.
Yeah, that was unscripted, definitely, yes.
Well, she's remarkable. Now, did she and Lattimore have a special relationship?
In the early years, they worked together tremendously. Actually, there's on the Gwen McCrae, there's a cut there with her and Lattimore doing Let's Straighten It Out, which was Lattimore sold about 6 million records on Let's Straighten It Out. That was a huge hit for Lattimore in the 70s.
Well, speaking of millions of records, Henry, there was a recording back in the early 50s by the Charms called Hearts of Stone. Now, that sold millions and millions of records. Was that pretty unusual in the 50s?
In those days, it was. That was one of the first, I think, I'm almost sure, well, I know that was one of the first records, R&B, race, whatever you want to call it, 1955, other than Nat King Cole or, you know, those Ink Spots or something like that, that crossed over into the Billboard pop charts. It was number one on the Billboard pop, the R&B charts, or race charts, whatever they called them then, you know? And I think that record crossed over, I'm pretty sure it did, into the Billboard pop charts.
Was that about, the middle 50s? Was it 53, 54?
1955, about the same time as James Brown. 1954, 1955.
Well, back in the 50s, was there any such thing as a gold record? Were awards presented like that? What was the protocol back in those days for that kind of music?
It was thank you, ma'am. It was thank you, period.
Who are the Charms? I'd like to run that that track for the listeners. In fact, I just
remember the leader was Otis Williams. Otis Williams and the Charms.
I see. And did the Charms go on to do other tracks that were?
Oh yeah, they had a pretty big hit with Ling Ting Kong. Actually, the follow-up record. Was a song basically I wrote called Two Hearts, Two Kisses, which Pat Boone covered this record. That was his very first record. He covered that record.
I see.
Called Two Hearts, well, Two Kisses.
I'd like to take a moment to run the Hearts of Stone. It's a precious song, and it's early, and it was one of your original huge hits, and I imagine many of our older listeners know it. Now, you see, if it came out in 55, I would have been 2 years old, so I think I missed it. nonetheless, it's a great track. Bob, if you would run the Hearts of Stone track, please.
Hearts made of stone. Love you have for them, they just won't take. You can ask them, please break, and all your love is that thing. This heart is stone, will cause a pain. Although you love them, they'll stop you just the same. Please break.
Henry, I had to laugh out loud. When she hits the no, it's really quite fabulous. And I would assume that at the time, that was that particular sound was that was very, very fresh.
Yeah, well, I was sort of the beginning of doo-wop, too. It was sort of the beginning of the doo-wop style, a little bit. But if you notice, pretty much all my big hit records, Peter, if you notice, they all start with a good dance beat. Because whatever the reason is, I am into dance music.
I see. Well, what was the studio like that was recorded in?
I recorded that at the King Recording Studio in Cincinnati.
I see. So it was, like Ampex reel-to-reels?
It was an Ampex machine was recorded on, reel-to-reel.
I see. And then it was distributed on 45s, no doubt.
Yes, the 45s would come into play in... And I came out in the 45.
I see. And that's what was your personal life like along during those times? Now, here you are, you're a young man, and suddenly you're selling millions of records on a new style of music. This is the beginning of doo-wop, and those had to be heady times. What was your life like then?
Well, my life like was 24/7 in the recording studio and selling records. That's what I did, and that was my focus.
I see. It's obvious that you love it. And yes, I've noticed throughout all of your music, all of them have a wonderful dance feel to them, and it's sort of a powerful. How can I put it? It's not necessarily the equalization, but the dance beat is clearly apparent. Now, was that particular song out at the time that there was, what were those television shows that had the, the kids all danced? Who was that guy?
Oh, that was Dick Clark Show, et cetera?
Oh, yes, those shows, yes. Was that during that?
They didn't have any shows like that. Everything had to be done on radio airplay.
I see. And was this nationally? It had to be played nationally and played for a long time. Well, that's amazing. That truly is amazing. Well, getting back to Gwen McCrae and her work, she and her husband, now George McCrae, they were married during the entire time that you guys worked together?
Yes, I guess they were married. Yeah, they married, but they stayed together about 5 or 6 years. I have the Rock Your Baby and Rockin' Chair and a few of the hits. And then whatever reason, they dissipated. Those are the things that happened.
I see. But, well, did Gwen fare as well as George McCrae? Now, George McCrae's hit Rock Your Baby, of course, was huge. Did Gwen ever equal that in terms of sales or prominence in the music business?
As far as my sales can, no, I've never. That was like one of my biggest records I ever had. Maybe 20 million records worldwide. I mean,
was that Rockin' Chair or was that Rock Your Baby?
No, Rock Your Baby.
Rock Your Baby.
Gwen's record was a very big record, sold quite a few million, 3 or 4 million, but nothing compared to Rock Your Baby.
I see. Remarkable stuff. We have I'd like the listeners to hear Rockin' Chair if they don't know it. It was a wonderful track. I have a remix here that was done by Larry Sanders, and it's edited down to 225. You've probably not heard this version before, Henry, but to give you an idea of the power of Gwen's voice, and this is just an introduction. When you hear Gwen's medley that Glenn prepared, the jazz track, jazz freak track will just blow you away. But for right now, Bob, if you would roll the Rockin' Chair track, please. Ooh.
so rock me, baby. Ooh, in my rocking chair, baby. Ooh, all night long till the morning comes, just a groove, baby. Chair all night long, baby. Good loving, daddy. Ooh, let me be your rocking chair. Just rock me away from there. Let's get it on. Come to me, baby. Ooh, let me be your rocking chair. Just rock me away from there.
Amazing track, just an amazing track, and you'd just be amazed to see the reaction.
You notice who was in the background?
No, who was it?
That was George McRae singing the high note in the background.
Kidding? You are kidding? Because I so thought that was a female backup vocal.
No, that was George.
I'll be darned. Well, that's a clue I would have never guessed in a million years. And what a remarkable, remarkable track. You know, music like that just stays in your heart. It really is, and there's the reason that it's called soul. And what a wonderful gift you've given so many people. You've really taken us all over your musical lifetime through so many wonderful memories. And of course, Gwen McRae is one of them, as well as George McRae. And it just never ceases to amaze me. In the early days when you were playing in the bands, you played, even after the military, you played with lots of bands in clubs that were primarily soul type of clubs. Or tell us about your band experience after the military.
Well, after the military, I didn't spend too much time. Like I said, basically after the military, I hopped my trumpet. And I went into the record business at California because I felt that I'd rather get into the business end of the music business than being a musician all my life.
I see. And that was when you were selling 78s out of your trunk. Is that
That's
true?
That's right. Mm-hmm.
And you weren't selling to folks with jukeboxes. You weren't selling to club owners with jukeboxes, because I don't think jukeboxes ever used 78s, did they?
Oh, sure did. That's all. Absolutely.
I had no idea.
Yeah.
And so when you were doing that, you sold to jukebox owners in addition to just how did you market that? How did you manage to pull that off?
Basically, there were not too many record stores. It's like a deja vu. After the war, there were no record stores like now. The record stores are disappearing. It's kind of weird, but it's like a whole cycle, you know?
Well, that's very true when you get right down to it. And record stores do play a huge part in a community's musical taste.
The marketing,
by stocking.
You know? Now, if you really want to buy a record, you have to go to Walmart or Target. There's no little mall store. There used to be a lot of mall stores. A lot of little record mom-and-pop stores selling catalog and records, you know?
I see.
Now it's disappearing.
I see. Well, it's true, and it's your musical side, as I say, that the music over at your website is remarkable, as much as it provides a way to obtain these, and the music, the quality is absolutely wonderful. From all of these that you're putting in your music store, they come from the original master tapes. What is
Well, some of most. A good deal of them. I had to do some work on some of them, you know, we've disappeared. Some of that stuff just disappears, you know, all through the years. But basically, the sound is always great. I've always been a big believer in the right sound.
I see. Well, getting back to Casey, I know I'm jumping around, but your history, there's so much of it. It's hard to know how to approach.
It's like walking, seeing
the ocean. If Casey decided that George McRae, because of his vocal qualities and hitting those notes, I would have never known that he just did the high end on the Glenn McRae track that we just heard. He had George McRae do that track. So what was Casey's first track that was? How did that work? Because Casey and the Sunshine Band are huge, yet they gave away their first huge hit. What's the deal on that?
Well, then they expected at that time, Casey and Rick, they expected to be songwriters and producers. This was, you know, before. Then they started to fool around with putting a band together, and they cut some tracks like Queen of Clubs. I mean, these were before the big hit. Like Queen of Clubs, and they had just a couple of little records that didn't do too much at the time. Until, of course, Get Down Tonight, and then... Actually, I sent Casey to Europe, and that's where the records really broke out, in Europe, in England. And I released Get Down Tonight, and we did fairly well with it here in the States. And then I sent them over to England, and it broke wide open. I brought them back in, and the record became number one, and right after that, there was just 7 number one hit records around the world.
Well, why do you think that the track Queen of Clubs, did so well in... I'm told that that did very, very well in Europe, or in England, but not so well here. What was it about that track that appealed to that market, do you think?
I wish, if I could tell you, I would do it again. It's music, and you just don't know what people's tastes really are, you know? The other thing is like, when I get into a studio and try to make a record, I try to get a good funky beat and a good bass sound so everybody can dance to it, and I try to go along that route. And if it comes out, it must have come out pretty good through the years.
I see. Well, KC was a remarkable find, and he actually came from your warehouse, I think you said. He was sweeping.
He worked in the warehouse. And he was actually, 4 o'clock in the morning, he was up in that studio working. Yep, he did his work.
I see. Was he doing it by adding tracks? Was he trying to do it all himself? Or at 4 a.m.
Him and Rick Finch.
I see.
The two of them. Rick was like an engineer, and Casey did the vocals. They put it together. It was just one of those combinations that was a hit combination.
Well, I've read that the studio that you're referring to was sort of a off the beaten path. It was in a warehouse somewhere. What was that like?
Yeah, it was in my. I had a big distribution company in Florida, Tone Distributors, where I distributed every independent label. It was Atlantic's first distributor, Motown's first distributor, Stack's first distributor, every independent. And that was a good part of my business. But again, I always had in my back pocket, I always had a recording studio. And upstairs above my office, I had this little 8-track studio where Clean Up Woman by Betty Wright was recorded.
Which was fabulous.
Directed. Yeah. Lucky Nassau, Beginning of the End.
Yeah.
Recorded. Rock Your Baby was recorded. The early Casey stuff was recorded upstairs in an 8-track studio.
That's just amazing. Yet the quality of the recordings is equal to anything I've heard. I mean, especially when you hear it in the new digital form, it's very crisp, very clean. It's not muddy. Well done.
Well, that was part of my reputation, too, of having a great sounding record.
I see. What is the phrase? It has to do with some of the KC and the Sunshine Band's work. something called echo rain. Is that the correct term? What was that term I came across today? Something about the echo.
Well, we, you know, like any other recording studio, we had little tricks of equalizing and putting echo on the voices. You know, that, you know, that's some of the recording tricks that we used. Like, you know, it's pretty common in those days.
Yeah. Well, when you hear some of those tracks today, people don't always realize that things that you do in music, like a particular riff or a particular effect, becomes a fad for a while, and it's like it gets picked up, and then everybody does it for a while, and then it seems to go away.
Yeah, then you know, then you have young engineers that do their own thing; they change the sound. You know, music keeps changing. You know, every decade it changes. Like I've been through, and I guess you yourself, you've seen it change from time to time.
Well, Henry, how did you find the Sunshine Band? Because if it was KC and the engineering person, or the recording, the fellow who ran the equipment, where did the Sunshine Band come from?
Well, I guess it was a name that we had to come up with. We're in Sunshine State, Florida. And that's where the KC and the Sunshine Band came from.
I see. Did you audition various musicians?
Hello? Yeah, hello?
Yes. I'm wondering if you auditioned various musicians to be part of the Sunshine Band. How did you choose them?
There was a small group called the Ocean Line that Casey used to work around with. And we just worked around them and built the band around the Ocean Liners, with Casey doing his thing and Rick doing his thing. Of course, when those records started to get real big, they all went on the road and did fantastic. Which Casey's doing today and still doing great out there, by the way.
We have a medley that Glenn has put together of Casey and the Sunshine Band, and as a reminder, everyone knows Casey's music, but as a reminder, and because we love the music too, did you do a special? We'd like to run that as well. I'm getting at, but did you do a special bass line for that? What were the times like? In other words, what I'm thinking here is that KC is probably the very first disco that I would actually call disco track that I was really exposed to. Was this a new sound?
Oh, definitely. It was a definitely new sound. It was a simple, great, the bass lines, if you listen to the bass lines, they're fantastic. I mean, again, that's the one thing I always put my head to and my ears to was the bass sound. And I did that with Casey, working along with him, as the group got bigger and bigger.
I see. Well, you're called one of the very pioneers of the whole sound. And certainly with Rock Your Baby and Casey and the Sunshine Band, I would say that you sort of started the ball rolling. Is that generally the what's understood about that particular time? What were the other tracks that were being played along with those?
You mean the other hit tracks that Casey had?
Like yeah. And the DJs, what were they playing in general during that time frame along with Casey? What was that particular time frame like musically?
Would you believe it? At that time, I basically had so many hits, I used to only listen to my own record. To what anybody else was doing. That's
well,
the truth, really. Because at that time, I had like 23 gold and platinum records. I mean, you start naming them, you know, with KC and Peter Brown and Foxy and Betty Wright, and Lattimore. I mean, I can go on and on and on. We had Bobby Caldwell coming through with this, What You Won't Do for Love. I mean, I'd like, phew, one hit. I used to only listen to my records. I didn't know what was happening otherwise.
Well,
I didn't, you know, every once in a while I listened to the radio, see what else they were playing, but most of the time I heard my records.
I see. Well, I remember back in the 60s, And I think I remember the very first time I heard a Casey track. It was at a retreat out by a lake in North Florida. And it was the Get Down Tonight track. Bob, let's run the Casey and the Sunshine Band medley that Glenn put together, please.
Hey, Peter, that had to be in the 70s, not the 60s.
Was it? 70s. Probably so. I yep. get a lot of blurs along those times.
Okay,
hit it, Bob. Comments along the way of Glenn's wonderful medley that takes no small amount of effort to put together a segment like that. It's the top of the hour, so I'll remind you, the toll-free line is 877, the number 4, head-on. That translates into 877-443-2366. If you have unlimited long distance, you can use that. It's area code 304-658-3333. That's 304-658-3333. For tonight only, we're not using Peter at headonradionetwork.com for email because of some network difficulties, but you can, if you'd like to communicate via email, you can use pgodbold, that's P-G-O-D-B-O-L-D, at yahoo.com. That's for tonight only. Henry, what happened, the event that took place in Chicago, with burning the disco records and the whole disco sucks, and basically there was a riot at a baseball arena there. And now, many people view that as an attempt by the macho rock and roll lovers to stamp out gay liberation and the black pride movement. So there was a whole political aspect that a lot of people are not aware of. They call the music plastic, and they call the people, what was the word they used? I've forgotten the word. Plastic was one of the words. Here, I might have it here somewhere. But in any case, it seems to me that mindless, that was the other, that what they're really saying is the music was effeminate. And what I'm thinking here is that basically that only by killing disco could the rock and rollers, at least the macho ones who didn't particularly care for gay folk and black folk, their masculinity was threatened by this new type of music. And they were longing for the days of, beer and women that didn't particularly resist. That had to impact you terribly because you were at your very peak in the 70s. What happened to the whole dance music industry in the 70s, in the late 70s, after that event?
Well, I guess that could have been the beginning of the end after that fiasco in Chicago, you know? But, you know, I guess it became political, and anything that's political, how do you fight it, you know? But if you think about it, Peter, we're still dancing, and disco is basically still here. That is the bottom line. You know, whatever they try to do, disco and dancing and music, and every TV show, every commercial, all you hear are Casey songs, Village People songs. I go on and on and on with all the great disco songs. That's all you hear today. So we're still here. They may be gone. I mean, that's the way I feel about it.
Yeah, we had a remarkable guest. His name was Alex Natick, a while back, who was from Europe and the Italo disco, and absolutely loved it. And when he moved to the United States, he would go into record stores, which still existed at the time, and ask for, where's the disco stuff? And the people would just look at him funny, and he didn't get it. Apparently, this whole disco sucks thing never happened in Europe, and they just happily kept dancing. Did your record?
One thing about Europe, they're great. They're great when it comes to the bits of music. They just love the music, American music.
Yeah,
that doesn't seem to change.
I see. Well, I've got to tell you that it did. It did go underground for a number of years, but no matter what you call it, it's still rock and roll. It's still disco. It's still disco to me. Henry, I came across a track at your website, which is henrystonemusic.com today, that just blew me away. I would be embarrassed to tell you how many times I've played this today. It's the radio version of a track by Lattimore called Nana Puddin', and it's just fabulous. You know, it is the music from back in the day, but it's a new song. Tell us about Lattimore and his history and how he came to do this new track, which I want to play because it's just fabulous.
Well, Lattimore's been with me, good 30-some-odd years. And I brought him into the TK family as a musician to play along with my TK group at the time. And I had a record with Lattimore in about 73, 74. Because let's straighten it out. It sold at least 6 million records. It was a huge record. It's still played everywhere in the world. And Lattimore, I just kept with him and kept along with him. And he, like everybody else, he quieted down. And then a couple of years ago, I decided to record him again. I recorded his Back at You CD with Lattimore. The first record we had out was a song called My Give a Damn Gave Out a long time ago. Pretty cool record. And Santa Puddin' is the latest release that just came out about 2 weeks ago.
Well, it's remarkable, and you really do have to stop by henrystonemusic.com because you're going to find treasures there that you thought were nowhere to be found at his music store. And what label is Nana putting on? In other words, since you're doing it all digitally now, do you associate it with a label?
Yeah, Henry Stone Music. Actually, the label, Henry Stone Music USA. Then I have little offshoot labels, like I call the Lattimore on a Lat Stone record, Lat Stone. But it all goes through henrystonemusic.com.
I see. Well, Bob, let's run the... I know you can't... The listeners, judging from the title of the song, Nana Puddin', are just thinking, what could this possibly be? But trust me, you're going to be bowled over. Bob, please run the Nana Puddin'.
It's a good one.
I'd rather be